For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Get ready, Ohio. FanDuel, America's number one sports book, is coming to the Buckeye State. And to kick things off, you can get started with $100 in free bets as an early sign-up bonus. Plus, when you sign up today with promo code OHIOFD, you'll be all set when FanDuel goes live in Ohio. Then you can bet on all your favorite teams in all your favorite sports with $100 in free bets. Just download FanDuel's top-rated sportsbook app. It's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Ohio, this is your chance to get in on the action. Join today with promo code OHIOFD. Make every moment more with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 or older and present in Ohio. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable free bets that expire 7 days after FanDuel accepts its first real money sports wager in Ohio, 1-1-23. Unique user identity verification required. Offer ends on the go live date. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey guys, we'll get to film study in just a minute, but I got to share this with you. Do you know what that sound is? It's the sound of me opening up my fresh can of Liquid Death. Make sure you guys are checking out Liquid Death. I love it. I've been drinking a ton of it lately. There's something magical about it. Somehow the water in a can just seems colder than any bottle I've used before. Make sure you're checking out Liquid Death. Pick it up next time you're at the grocery store. I love it.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're here to discuss the offense from the week four game against the Bills, one that really started out well. Obviously, the Ravens let another big lead get away at home, which is unfortunate. One of the best things that I find cathartic about this is talking to someone very knowledgeable about football after the fact and kind of getting our heads straight about, I can't think of anyone more level-headed or knowledgeable than Childs Walker. Childs, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ken. Thanks for having me. I feel like I'm on a bit of a cold streak here, though, because the last time I was on, we did a preview pod talking about Ronnie Stanley and Michael Pierce. That hasn't turned out so well.
No, it hasn't.
We talked a lot about injuries, and sure enough, that's been the narrative with both of those guys. And then and now we have this game to talk about, which has the fan base in quite a tizzy. So yeah, I feel like maybe I'm a little cursed right now, but we'll soldier through.
Yeah, don't really believe in that stuff anyway. So that's no, that's good. No. So we will continue. And I know, you know, from your writing, it's very clear that the level-headedness, in particular, where you are right now, from your article today, I really liked. The close losses have really mounted up on this fan base, on this team. Probably on the coaching staff and perhaps even on Steve Bisciotti in terms of five straight losses by a total of 12 points over the last, three last year, two this year. You know, the second consecutive big lead loss, obviously very disturbing in terms of, it coming with a passing offense, basically taking them down pretty thoroughly in the second half. But I want you to take us into a little bit of what was in your article this morning, some of the mood of the team maybe, and I don't want to talk you through it. You start us off.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you talk about being level-headed and I do try to do that. I mean, I always try to think through the game first as if I didn't know all of what happened last year and I didn't necessarily know the mood of the fan base, and then sort of bring that stuff back into it after I've tried to think through the game, you know, as cool-headedly as I can. And I think it's important to do that in part because I think that's what the coaches and the players have to do, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they can't afford to get swept up in a moment like that. I mean, they have to move on and sort of figure out the nuts and bolts things they can fix, but really always be thinking forward. And that's basically what most of them will tell you in the, even in the moments immediately after a loss like that. I mean, they're already mostly thinking ahead. I mean, you know, Sunday was interesting, I think, because of the Marcus Peters outburst on the sideline at the end. Obviously, that's not something that we normally see. Mm-hmm. He was very frustrated. He was directly frustrated with Harbaugh. And we still have not heard from him on that. I mean, he was gone from the locker room by the time that we got in after the podium session. So, I mean, we'll see if he talks this week and, you know, explains what was going through his head. Harbaugh obviously has sort of downplayed that and said, mm-hmm. you know, I love Marcus. I love the fact that he cares that much. I, you know, I couldn't have more respect for his football knowledge. And, you know, I think everybody will tell you there's not a smarter football guy in the locker room than Marcus Peters. So not surprising that he would have a strong view on how that situation should have been handled. But I think this is probably something that Harbaugh has learned over the years, you know, sort of not to overreact to a situation like this and say, you know, I understand this guy. He's an important part of the team in a nuts and bolts way. He's an important part of the team culture. I'm not going to overreact to it. We'll talk about it at some point. And, you know, I know how to get through these situations because we've done it before. So, I mean, that was mostly what we heard from the players in the locker room as well. I mean, you know, the calm guys were pretty calm, like you would think they would be. I mean, Calais mm-hmm. Campbell has kind of seen it all over 15 years. And I mean, he said, you know, this isn't the end of the world. I mean, Lamar, same thing, you know, he went back to 2019 and said, look, we were 2-2 in 2019. We got blown out in week 4 and we went on to be the best regular season team in the league. Then you had some guys like Mark Andrews who were a little more defiant and clearly, you know, probably didn't love some of the questions, but I mean, the tone was very much trying to put it in perspective and say, yes, we're disappointed, but it's early and we know how to get over stuff like this.
So the thing I actually rushed out of the stadium, because one of the things when we're done at the stadium, when we record certain things while we're there, and then I rush home, do the rest of my analysis and write articles and whatnot, just like you, I'm sure, in terms of except you're in the press box and you're right. Going down to the clubhouse and you're taking quotes. But we're rushing to get our work done after the game. Anyway, I missed the Marcus Peters explosion. So I didn't see it at the game. I heard about it afterwards. And by the time I got to the car, Harbaugh was already at the podium. And Harbaugh was probably, almost seems like he was at a, not awake, because those could be happy, a funeral, a morgue, you know, whatever, in terms of his responses. He was very curt. You know, I think he gave the reporters very quickly the understanding he really didn't want to talk about what had just happened. I don't know if that was related to Peters, but how did you observe his kind of interview demeanor after the game?
I thought it was pretty typical for him after a difficult loss. I mean, it did not strike me as overly somber. And in fact, I actually asked him the Marcus Peters question, and I was surprised that he answered it to the degree that he did. I mean, I thought he might just sort of say, hey, that's between me and him. You know, we'll talk about it during the week. I don't expect it to be a problem. Instead, he gave a little bit more of a personal answer and, you know, sort of spoke to how he views Marcus Peters specifically. And, you know, I thought actually answered the question. So, I mean, I mean, and then on Monday, you know, when we did our typical, you know, Monday session with him, I thought he did a good job of going through, you know, the sort of particulars of the game. Is he's often very good after a loss on those Mondays after a loss. He's often kind of goes into teacher mode. And a lot of times he'll really tell you more about what's going on with the team in a technical way than he does after a win. So I wasn't surprised that he was that way this Monday. So I didn't read his mood coming out of that game to be any different than it's been coming out of a lot of tough games in the past.
Okay. That's, first of all, that's good. I want to hear two things about that. The first was there was a, some sort of a psychology question that came up today in terms of, is this going to weigh on the mindset of the team, where he referenced the team's psychologist?
Yeah, that was kind of an interesting answer. Because I mean, I think the question was basically like, you know, how are you going to tend to the mood of the team after, you know, after another loss like this? I mean, that was the, I don't remember the exact wording of the question, but that was the gist of it. And he did take kind of an interesting tact with it and brought up the team psychologist, which, you know, I didn't necessarily expect him to do, but I didn't necessarily read a ton into it either. I mean, my takeaway from that answer was he was saying, look, I'm not worried about these guys. They know how to deal with, you know, difficult times in the course of a season. What we really have to do is clean up our mistakes as a team, not worry about how guys are feeling right now. You know, not that that's irrelevant. I mean, it's always a part of sports, but I think he almost meant it as a statement of confidence about his guys, that he doesn't think they're going to be dwelling on this in an emotional way, that, you know, it's really, they got to clean up football stuff.
Yeah, that's great. And I would hope for exactly that from Harbaugh. Is extremely good in terms of understanding, first of all, what information to give out and what information not to give out. One thing I kind of wondered is if anybody would ask him a question about the process of decision-making that goes into the two-point conversion, because it's, sorry, not the two-point conversion, the going forward on fourth and right. Two from the two, awful similar. But I know that's potentially a question that could start peeling a scab, but it's also the kind of question that I think if people understood what the process was, that they would understand better that Harbaugh isn't juggling a ton of things to do it. He's not having to do a lot of math himself. It's actually being framed up pretty easily for him. But I don't know if he's ever spoken to that. Has he ever spoken to the notion of a break-even probability?
I don't think he's put it exactly that way, but he has talked about the process in a little more detail in the past. Didn't so much this week. I mean, he again went through his sort of broader reasons for doing what he did. But I do think he has answered the process question in the past. And it's basically what you said. I mean, they have someone on staff who is, you know, has a good understanding of what the equation is, and that will be presented to him. And then he'll sort of incorporate that along with, you know, his sense of the flow of the game, his sense of the other team, his sense of how his offense is performing, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say make a combination gut analytical decision. I mean, that's, again, I don't know that that's exactly how he would put it, but I think that's basically how he's answered that question over the years.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's probably how he would put it. And I think relying on the model exclusively as it is probably, or relying on models, whatever they may have, is probably not perfect. But I promise people one mathematical walkthrough on this today and how this might be presented to Harbaugh. So I just want to go through this quickly because we talked a lot about some of the reasons to do it and not to do it on the defense show, but I thought we would just do this. So you need to find the break-even probability. That's the useful number in there to basically state to John Harbaugh, John, the possibility, if the probability is 41% or higher, then we should go for this. If the probability is lower than that, we should not. All right. But the break-even is 41. And I think, you know, the method in which you go through that, if fans kind of understood it, I think might help a little bit. So we just did it for this particular case using the Ben Baldwin model, which is out there. Ben Baldwin bot, if you follow him on Twitter, he'll often produce little pages of information that surprisingly it doesn't include the break-even probability, which it should. But here's the equation you need to solve. And if you're looking at the picture that I provided, you'll see Childs on the right and me on the left with that funny equation under me. This is the equation we're going to talk about. Very basic algebra. It's 0.49 is what Baldwin Bot says is the probability of the Ravens winning the game if they fail to make the two-point conversion. So I'm going to multiply. I'm going to take the two possible outcomes of making or missing the two-point conversion, the touchdown. Scoring from the touchdown from the two-yard line. On the left side of the equation, add them up. And then I have to have that total be equal to or greater than the probability of making a field goal will give them in terms of winning the game. So let me go through that. I think there's some terms in there that people will generally understand, but maybe it's a little bit more easier if we go through the example. So according to Baldwin, if they had missed on the two-point conversion, a lot of the touchdown attempt, they still win the game about 49% of the time. A lot of that was probably due to the fact that they'd have left the Bills close to the goal line, starting out a drive from there. Of course, the worst possible thing happened,
right,
and they came out to the 20-yard line on the play and got a much easier place to start. But if you take 0.49 times the probability of failure, which is 1 minus P, plus you add the probability of winning if they score a touchdown, which is 83%, times P, the probability of scoring that touchdown, that has to be equal or greater than 0.63. So when P, if you solve that, when P equals 0.41, 41%, then you have a break-even probability. That's the probability you need or higher in order to go for the touchdown there. It was a fairly easy call in my judgment. I would say, you know, since two-point conversions are normally about 45 to 50%, depending on the team, these conditions, they might have been worse. I think it's 43, 45, 47% would still be reasonable for the Ravens making it. So I think it was probably the correct move. But what I did is I asked people online what I thought their chance of making it was. And there were a few people who actually said, I think the chance was 45%, and that's why I would have wanted to kick. Well, if the chance is 45%,
you
really should have wanted to go for it. So anyway, yeah, that's the math. I won't spend any more time on that. I know you guys are listening on a pod in the car, but if you want to try and solve that equation yourself, go look at the picture of me and Childs that's on the Twitter promo for this, and you'll be able to see what it is.
Well, and again, you know, I don't think Harbaugh would lay out that equation for you, but I think basically the way he was thinking about it is he thought that if they kicked the field goal, they were probably going to lose the game 27-23.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you had to boil it down, that's really what was in his head. I think it was as simple as that.
And they probably would have.
Right. Right. So. And I find it hard to disagree with that. And I mean, I know you sort of talked about this. You talked about this on Twitter, and you talked about this in your defense notes and on the defense pod. But, you know, people in these situations always say, oh, I thought they should have kicked the field goal before what actually happened.
Yeah.
But I just, that's just not how the mind works, right? I mean, people are inevitably reacting to the result. I mean, they're analyzing the result, and I don't even blame people for that. It's the natural human impulse, right? But I think it's extremely hard for people, especially after an emotional loss, to take themselves back to the moment of decision rather than to incorporate what actually happened, right? I mean, I just think it's very difficult.
Yeah, I think you have to have something else in the game to quote unquote blame the loss on. So instead of that, you go to the roughing the passer penalty, or instead of that, you go to, you know, some other play in the game that didn't work. There are people who can dissociate on that basis, I think, but I agree with you that it is not normal to basically be able to have I think it's more likely that people go backwards than really are able to put themselves in exactly that point in time to do it. There's something else going on here, though, because John Harbaugh has an aggressive style. And, you know, one of the natures of quote unquote being aggressive, which really just means making correct mathematical decisions that are closer to the line than other coaches right, would push it, is that there are more high leverage decisions. And it's really not that exactly as your small losses that accumulate. You're not really counting those. All the 4th-and-1 Tomlin punts that the Pittsburgh Steelers fans hate, believe me, they're costing the Steelers wins, but yeah, they're not really counting them in the same way. They're as Harbaugh as, you know, a missed 2-point conversion or this missed touchdown opportunity. And that's what's really strange about it is we don't celebrate the wins. And, you know, the 4th-and-1 call against Kansas City, 100% the correct call. I mean, I absolutely the correct call. You know, they went for it. They made it in that particular case. And it just doesn't seem like we celebrate that as much as we, you know, want to cane this decision for what it was.
No, I agree. But I think it's inevitable. So I don't spend a lot of time feeling agitated at the people who process it the way that they do, because I mean, okay, it's human nature, and you know, we know how the aftermath of a game like that's going to be, right? Yeah. And it's followed the script exactly. So we probably don't need to perseverate it anymore here.
Yeah, I agree. The only other thing I would say is I really don't like people to throw out the forget about the math. I don't care about the math. You don't even bother telling me the math kind of thing. This is the way these problems are solved in football now. If you want to look at the model and say these assumptions aren't correct, perfectly reasonable. Hey, I worked in model validation as my last job as an actuary. You know, it's perfectly reasonable to want to look at a model, but it's not reasonable to say, don't use a model to make this decision, or don't tell me you used a model to make this decision because I know better. That's ridiculous.
Well, yeah. And it's out of, as you said, it's out of step with how teams are doing it. So, I mean, you're just not, you know, you're not with the times of the sport if you're refusing to incorporate that. So, yeah.
It's funny in baseball. We now, you know, we went through the Moneyball period, and now, you know, the Moneyball people are all in charge of the sport pretty much. And, you know, people like Elias and Mejdal and all the guys are running the thing and, you know, running the slick operations. In football, we're getting there. You know, the Cleveland Browns are basically run by an analytics group now, in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think it's probably only going to get more, and not less as we move forward, and some of the dinosaurs kind of retire from coaching and in a lot of ways to hire new people.
Well, and also more and more of the people who buy teams are going to be of that mindset. They're going to come from worlds where that kind of thinking is just intrinsic to everything they do. And I mean, we've certainly seen that in other sports. So, I mean, yeah, we're not going back.
Completely agree. There's, by the way, the PFF lost their head of R&D to a new, and this has me really scared, to a new, I think it's a hedge fund group that's trying to put together models of how to accumulate the best talent for pro sports franchises. So it sounds like this guy wants to own sports franchises, probably has billions. And, you know, he's hired one of the really great applied mathematicians to be, you know, one of the partners in his group that's doing this. I'm already worried about that team joining the NFL when they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Really nasty day in terms of rain, but a little bit of variation from half to half. The second half a lot worse in terms of the rain. Do you guys get a sense of that when you're in the press box, or do they have the windows all nice and shut up and you're
Yeah, we certainly don't get as good a sense of it as you do sitting in the stands. Now certainly that was a storyline going into this game. So I mean, I think it was something that we were all trying to keep an eye on. And I mean, you know, when the rain picked up, I feel like it picked up maybe early in the second quarter, maybe midway through the second quarter. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly, but I remember thinking at that point that the Ravens were in fantastic position because they had built up a lead and the weather seemed to be getting worse. I mean, it seemed like they had gotten their important work in while it wasn't too bad. And now It was going to be much tougher for Buffalo to come back. Obviously it didn't turn out that way, but I mean, that was my thought. That was my thought when it first started to come down.
Yeah, and that's a great point. We go back to the flip of the coin. I mean, Buffalo won it. They didn't defer, which is very unusual. Well,
right.
Somewhat unusual, let's call it. They took the ball first, and I think it was weather-related that they did it. They'd also scored, I think, on their last eight first drives. You might know this. I put it in the notes.
I think that's right. It was. I know people were quoting that stat in the press box. It was either seven or eight. Yeah, but it was some. It was some. You know, fairly extraordinary streak. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on a little bit and talk about Lamar. The Bills used Tremaine Edmonds a little bit to spy him in this game, had some modest effectiveness with that. Of course, Lamar did get free a few times on scrambles and is still coming up with a very good, by the way, scramble yards versus sack yards relationship on the area. Still, one stat I like to look at is because Lamar really intentionally does not throw the ball away because he always thinks he can make a play with his legs or perhaps late with his arms. And if you add up the sacks and the scramble yards he's had, he's at something like 4 yards per carry. It might be 3.8 now this year. So It's hardly a throwaway play when you can get that kind of a return on it. So I think that's been good. But Tremaine Edmonds was used as a spy some in this game. He's a pretty good pass defender. And unfortunately, the Bills are one of those teams. One of the huge edges they have over the Ravens is they have good inside linebackers in terms of pass coverage, and both him and Milano are just terrific. And I thought they both played pretty well in this one.
Yeah. I thought against the run too. I mean, it was very striking going back and watching the game. How good those guys are, how often you saw them making quick reads and, you know, then not just getting to where they needed to be, but finishing the play. I mean, it's just, you know, I just kept thinking over and over and jotting down over and over in my notes, you know, that guy's just a really, really good player. He's really good at his job. And, you know, sadly, we don't see that consistently from the Ravens inside linebackers. I mean, I know we're not talking about defense, but I mean, I did think that was a stark contrast in this game, how those guys played. But, I guess one of the overall things that struck me in reviewing Lamar's performance is he did not look downfield very much in this game. Now, maybe that's not terribly surprising because we know the Bills hardly blitz at all, and they're able to get pressure without blitzing, which, you know, means you don't necessarily have those attack chances that he's had against previous opponents. But gosh, I mean, he wasn't even attempting passes downfield, really. I don't know what his longest air yard pass of the game was, but it couldn't have been that long. So that component of their game was really taken out. And look, I think you have to give Buffalo credit. I mean, they're good. I mean, they have tremendous edge guys. They have the good inside linebackers, and you know, they didn't give him a lot to take shots at.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I think that you can feel good about after this game is it's a very talented football team they lost to. I feel that about Miami as well. And Miami may have problems without Tua, but that's a very good football team and one that's likely to be around come mid-January. You know, it's both of those losses. I mean, they're bad losses because they're, you know, big comebacks and you had it, but you know, at least they were to good teams. At least you don't blow a big lead against Detroit or something and have them come back against you. It's a little different.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing that struck me about Lamar is that I thought his biggest missed opportunity throws were mostly plays where he was affected by pressure. I don't know if you charted that specifically, but that was something that struck me in rewatching the game that maybe was not as clear to me as I was watching it at the time. I mean, like there was a play early in the game on a drive that ended with them kicking a field goal where Andrews did break free in the end zone and Lamar overthrew him. But in looking back at it, Lamar did have to throw the ball more quickly than he would have wanted to because he was under pressure. And there were, I think, multiple plays like that in the game, including obviously the big fourth down play at the end. So, I mean, that, you know, we thought Buffalo's ability to pressure without blitzing would be a major story in the game. And it ended up being a major story in the game.
Yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, we can do a little bit on the pass rush now because you've teed it up so nicely. But they rushed 24 times, 5-6 times, and 6-1 time in the game. So almost an 80% rate of non blitzes, which is high for anybody. What was incredible about that is even with a 4-man pass rush 24 times, they got pressure 15 out of 31.
Yeah,
that's unacceptable. I mean, yeah. They obviously a tough game for the tackles in both cases. I've seen a lot of very conciliatory comments and tweets about Fa'alele's play and Moses's. I haven't really seen a lot of conciliatory about Moses' play, but neither of them really played very well. That's the truth of the matter. They both kind of were getting beat, and I'll go through that some in the offensive line play. But
yeah,
Lamar only had 7 times in the whole game, despite all this 4-man rush where he had a 3-second pocket and an ample time and space. And those plays didn't go well, by the way. 5 of 7 for 18 yards on those plays.
Right. So
wet field, wet a lot of things, wet ball, obviously wasn't good there. With the ball out quickly, which is where the Ravens have made some good hay this year, particularly against teams like Miami, where they had the good slant pass to Bateman. 7 of 9 for 39 yards. So that's, you know, 4.3 yards per play. That's not particularly good either. But they had 15 plays for 77 yards, a little bit over 5 yards per play when there was pressure. So just overall a pretty crappy day throwing the football. So,
yeah. And I know we're probably going to talk about Bateman a little bit more later, but I mean, I did think one of the other key plays was that play in the third quarter, third down pass from Lamar. I think it was 3rd and 8. And, you know, it was a timing route and the ball goes off Bateman's hands. If he catches that ball, it's certainly a first down, could have potentially been a much bigger play. Mm-hmm. Now look, there are a lot of factors there. I mean, you know, you mentioned the slick conditions. Bateman was already dealing with a foot injury at that point that may have played into it. At the same time, I think you expect a number one wide receiver to catch that ball. I mean, you know, it's basically hits him in stride. It's off his hands. And that could have been a major play in the game because the Bills get the ball back right there and they march down for the game tying touchdown. So that was a pivotal moment.
Yeah, that was certainly his big drop of the game. And if you look at this, at least I've seen multiple scorings of this, but one of them is the Bills had 6 drops in the game, at least that's the way I counted it, and the Ravens had 2. And Bateman's were the 2 drops that the Ravens had. One of them was a ball that was a little bit behind him.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was going to be a good play anyway. That was the earlier one. The one you're talking about later was much more of a he could have done something with it after the catch. But he did make another great extension grab, perfect throw from Lamar. That
I thought that was probably Lamar's. That was probably Lamar's best throw.
Best throw of the game.
Yeah.
And he got it. Lamar also did get helped out, obviously, by Duvernay on the left sideline. Maybe the tandem of Duvernay and Andrews. I don't know if you were in Baltimore. I know you were in Baltimore. Yeah, in 2003. Were you already working for the Sun at that point?
I was working for the Sun, but I was not covering sports.
Okay. All right. So I don't know if you remember that Seattle game or not, but Marcus Robinson tipped the ball to Frank Sanders, and it was right down that left sideline in about the same spot. So it was in the big comeback against in Seattle. All right.
You may start noticing there are strange tall boys of beer in the bottled water section of your local stores. Well, that's not beer. It's actually mountain spring water from the Alps, and it's called Liquid Death. Why is this water called Liquid Death? Well, because it will brutally murder your thirst, and their infinitely recyclable Tallboy cans are helping to bring death to plastic bottles. They also donate 10% of the profits from every can sold to help kill plastic pollution. Those aluminum cans it comes in are recyclable and actually profitable for recycling facilities, so they won't just end up in your local landfill like plastic bottles. Go get Liquid Death at your local Woodman's, 7-Eleven, Roundy's, or Hy-Vee, or find Liquid Death retailer near you with their store locator tool at liquiddeath.com/filmstudy. That's liquiddeath.com/filmstudy.
All right. So what else do we have to talk about? The injury to Bateman obviously really concerns me in terms of what's going to happen going forward. The Ravens are playing so light on receivers. They actually won't have a problem finding a replacement for his snaps, but finding a replacement for the quality is a much bigger concern.
Now, when we asked Harbaugh about that on Monday, he did sort of downplay the seriousness of it, said that he saw Rashad on Monday, and Rashad told him that he was day-to-day. So I don't think you can count on him playing Sunday night, but I don't think you can rule it out either. And I agree that it's a big deal. I mean, even with some of the inconsistency that we've seen from him, they don't really have anybody else like him. So, yeah.
I mean, it'd be DeMarcus Robinson, I think, taking over at the X spot if that didn't happen. He certainly played a lot of snaps in this game, so that might make sense. But he's the man, and they got to have him back. And of course, anytime you hear midfoot injury, you know, one particular name comes to mind, and it's not a good one.
Nope.
So we let's not say it, because it's like saying Beetlejuice. He'll show up. Right. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about here? The injury to Hill, a significant injury to the Ravens, and obviously a gutsy run there to hop it out for that additional yardage.
I thought he was terrific on that whole drive. I mean, he had three double-digit runs on that drive, which obviously it's the drive that ends in the ultimate disappointment. But, I mean, great drive to that point, and he and Lamar were the key components to it. And Hill's done a really nice job of taking advantage of relatively limited running opportunities this year. I thought he really made plays on those runs too. I mean, I didn't think it was something where the seas just parted for him. I mean, he beat Milano kind of one-on-one to get outside on one of those runs. And then on the longer run where he ended up having the injury, I think it was a draw, and he sort of fainted at the line of scrimmage and then kicked it outside and really made something of it. So, I mean, he was a guy who, I think you would say he was a mild disappointment through the beginning of his Ravens career, and then missed all the last season. And, you know, Harbaugh said the other week, I mean, this is a time when the arrow is really pointing up for him. So, you know, to have him pull up like that at that moment, really unfortunate. At the same time, it does seem like the news on that is better than it might've been, because apparently it's not a really serious hamstring injury. And though I would not expect him to play this week, I would expect him to miss a few games probably. It doesn't seem like he's going to be out for a huge chunk of the season, which, you know, whenever you see a guy just pull up like that without any contact, I mean, you know, you think the worst, especially with a guy who's torn an Achilles. And so it seems like, you know, he maybe dodged a bit of a bullet there, even though it's going to certainly hurt them to be without him on Sunday.
Unbelievably painful to be without him, because he's been such a stark contrast to the Ravens' other backs that they've had. Even Dobbins, who's good, is a good cutback back, but he's not really the outside speed back the Ravens have needed. And, you know, they've had guys who they can't trust with the mesh point back there, like McCrary, it appears, because, I mean, otherwise he would still be around. Tyson Williams who would otherwise still be around, except they probably don't trust him with it either. And their reaction to it is bringing these veteran backs who are not terrible between the tackles necessarily, but when you know they can't run anywhere but between the tackles, or maybe, you know, just as a slight off tackle runner, they're not nearly as good. And that's where they are with the last four, you know, geriatric backs is probably a bad way to put it, but it's not, it gets the message across, you know, with Devontae Freeman last year. And actually there's more than that with Bell, with Murray.
It's at least five.
Yeah. Yep. Bell, Murray, and the two this year, help me out, Davis, who played two snaps in this game, and Drake.
Kenyon Drake. Yeah.
And you know, Hill, you know, to your point, took the job away from those guys. You know, they were brought in to be the 1-2 backs, and Hill played well enough basically that he became the number one back even before Dobbins returned.
Yeah, I was not at all certain that he was going to make the team coming into training camp. I mean, I honestly thought he might be on the wrong side of the bubble because they really seemed to like Beatty too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if they at least consider pulling up Beatty from the practice squad for this game, just get a little more speed in the mix, which they would be lacking if Hill in fact can't go. But yeah, I mean, I think Hill had easily been their most dynamic runner over the last few weeks. And I do think that's a big deal. And it's very much to his credit that he was able to get himself back to this point in his career, because I mean, you know, he was certainly adrift there for a couple of years.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, no one wants to be hurt and be missing time, but I mean, that's exactly, and Chads, I'm sure you're no different from me in this regard. One of the easiest articles to write during the preseason, during camp is who's going to not make the team. And basically just look at the fourth year players.
Yeah. The bubble guys.
Yeah. They're automatic bubble guys. Sure. If you're not a superstar at that point, in a lot of cases, if you're not re-signed at that point, you're really a bubble guy. And Hill was for that reason. And there'd be all the more reason for any, it wouldn't even have to be a guy they drafted. Beatty, I thought, was definitely going to make the team. He didn't, but they could have gone to somebody else's cast adrift R or one player and found a guy that they had, that, you know, that had upside that wasn't Justice Hill. But, you know, obviously they saw enough from Hill, and he certainly has contributed on special teams over the years when he's been healthy, that he was worthwhile to carry this time.
Another small piece of good news that came, maybe not even small, that came out on Monday, and it's probably not going to be a factor for the Bengals game, but it does seem like Gus Edwards is going to start practicing this week, which, you know, nobody said this openly, but I mean, I think there was some real pessimism around him at the beginning of camp, some real worry that he was a good bit behind where Dobbins was. So just the fact that he's seemingly going to be out there this week, which sets him on the path toward playing, you know, sometime before the middle of the season, that could be a pretty big deal.
I think it's a huge deal. And part of it comes down to the Ravens are really into a forced activation spot on him, right? So they have 3 weeks he can practice.
Correct.
Then they have to make a call.
Yep.
And so they could add him to walking wounded inactive, and given the healthy ability to bring up players in the practice squad, that might not be too costly to them. But I think it's not a move they would take lightly to start him practicing now.
No, they wouldn't start his practice clock unless they were legitimately optimistic that he's close to ready. So that's, you know, that's something for people to be excited about.
Yeah, no, I agree. Chance they bring up Tyler Beatty. You think he'll be a practice squad elevation this week then, would you guess?
I don't know. I haven't puzzled it out yet. It's certainly something we were talking about the other day, you know, in the reporters, just because of what we talked about. I mean, the Justice Hill, you know, presuming Justice Hill can't play on Sunday, it's hard to get too excited about the idea of Drake or Davis being the complement to Dobbins, right? Because we've seen that. We've seen that act, and it doesn't have a lot of upside. Now, I honestly don't know though where they are in their thinking on Beatty. We haven't asked Harbaugh about that for quite a while. I mean, when he didn't make the 53, you inevitably become a little bit of an afterthought. But there is some dynamism there, so it's at least something I think you have to think about. Yes.
It's one of the nice things so far is that even though, you know, the replacement level is a moving target over the season, it drops as you move on. And, you know, we've talked about that, I think, before, Charles, but the nice thing is that the Ravens, who had some players that they really liked and didn't have room for, Anthony Brown comes to mind. Beatty is certainly one. Mack is another. None of them have been taken yet off the practice squad, which I think is really fortunate.
Yeah, and you mentioned Mack. I mean, he could certainly come into play, you know, with Pierce out of the picture. So yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if Beatty factors at some point this season. I mean, they were extremely high on him in the summer and the beginning of camp. I don't think he made the most of his opportunities in training camp, but I certainly think they liked him enough that he'll get another shot at some point.
Did you notice in training camp that he had problems with the mesh point at all? Because that's one of the really big things. Is it was Lamar there and not able to pull late, or were there fumbles? You know, fumbles would be the most obvious way you'd probably see it, but even not being able to pull late is a problem.
You know, I don't remember that being a particular problem with him. It doesn't jump out in my mind. I mean, that's not to say there weren't a few examples of that. I mean, of course, we didn't get to see him play with Lamar in the preseason. So, I mean, we didn't see it under game conditions. I feel like there probably weren't as many big plays as maybe they thought there would be. I mean, there just weren't a lot of moments where he really flashed and you said, wow, that guy in the course of training camp, which, you know, I think with a new player, to some degree, that's what they're looking for.
All right, well, let's go on and talk about scheme a little bit, because to me, the story of the 2022 Ravens offense hasn't just been Lamar Jackson and the way he's kind of carried the team on its back. It's been the way the Ravens offense has been run. And for you folks out there, I know I've been talking about this on a weekly basis, but this is a historic offense. They have played for the season less than 11%. I believe it's less than 10%, 11 personnel the entire season. The lowest in the last since 2016 is 25% by the 2019 Vikings. Okay. There's no team which has come close to the number of heavies per play. Now I'm saying heavies, I'm adding the fullback, the tight end, and any sixth offensive lineman snaps. And the Ravens these last 3 weeks have been at 2.39, 2.35, and 2.31. I want to put that in perspective here, because I don't think any team in the last 6 years in the entire NFL has been as high as two for a season. Okay. So, and the Ravens are, you know, 3/10 of a player above that right now. But if you have 12 personnel on the field, you have two heavies. If you have 21 personnel on the field, you have two heavies. Those are considered by today's NFL standards extremely heavy formations. 11 personnel dominates the NFL right now. And this is the story about the Ravens offense in my thinking. The Ravens have put 14 personnel on the field five times. they've done some amazing things, but they're only playing about 1.8 was the number this last week, 1.8 wide receivers per play. So, you know, that's so far short of the three needed to field 11 personnel. It's not even funny. But is that getting talked about at all among the writers that you've seen?
You know, it's interesting. Not in those terms. I haven't heard, like, when we've had our sessions with Greg Roman, I have not heard him ask that specifically, like in a percentage of 12 personnel kind of way. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, he of course always he always goes back to using the medieval term, right? But I guess it's kind of literal in this case, in the sense that, you know, we're pulling trends that we probably haven't seen in decades, right? I mean, it really is a genuine blast from the past. It's not just a cute line.
Yeah. I tried to look at some of the other teams that ran really heavy, like the 2019 49ers were a team that, you know, just had all sorts of, you know, had, you could put Kittle on the field with Juszczyk play after play after play. They didn't run anywhere near as heavy, not anywhere near. It's really only that Vikings team that's done a little bit of it. And I wish the data went further back on this, and I could probably, you know, piece it together from stuff that's out there in game books and whatnot, but you know, it's a lot of work to do that. Walter Sharp Football has good information on the stuff, but this is historic. And I think that, you know, part of what they would say is that Isaiah Likely is more like a wide receiver than a tight end. And I mean, some of that's true, but he lines up in line. You know, they expect him to block. There is a big tell, though, and that is that Likely when he's in there, they're almost certainly going to pass the ball on the against the Bills. He was in for 26 snaps. 23 of those were passes and three were runs. And for the season, it's been 81% of his snaps that have been passes while they're in there. You go to the, flip them over to the two guys they've really been using as, and this was not the topic we need to get into. The two guys they've been using as blocking tight ends are Oliver and Boyle. They're 62% run when those guys are in a tight end.
So you're saying that would not work at the poker table?
Yeah. I think it's, yes, I'm bluffing hat you're wearing. Yes. Yes.
I guess the counter to that would be that, you might think that with an offense like that, they would have struggled to generate big plays, but they haven't, right? I mean, they've had plenty of 10 plus yard runs and plenty of 20 plus yard passes. I mean, they're near the top of the league in those. So I guess you could say in the big picture, it's worked pretty well, right?
Yeah, I think it has worked well. And I think it's extraordinary what Roman has done with a very limited set of personnel in terms of scheming for very high quality offense. And, you know, I think it's fair right now, just the way I think it's fair to celebrate the wins on good analytics plays, to celebrate Greg Roman a little bit right now for what he's done. I mean, this is one of the highest scoring offenses in the league, and it's not happening by accident, and it's not just 100% Lamar. Lamar's been terrific, but there are a bunch of other things that are being brought to play scheme-wise here that have really worked. So, yeah, I'm very positive on it. I think if you're a Roman hater, this is not the time to be talking about, although, you know, there's still plenty of that out there right now after any loss.
I was amazed. There were people in the aftermath of the game on Sunday talking about firing Greg Roman. Like, you know, are they going to fire Greg Roman on Monday? And I was like, how could that be your reaction to the first four games of the season? I mean, like, there's plenty to be concerned about if you want to be concerned, but you know, I don't know what pattern of thinking you're stuck in if that's your reaction to what we've seen so far this season. That just doesn't compute for me.
They are literally the second highest scoring team in the entire National Football League right now. I wouldn't have any clue how you get there. It boggles the mind. All right. We did not talk about this yet, but I kind of teed it up a little bit before. What's going on with Nick Boyle? Back 2 weeks now, yeah. Played four snaps the first week, none this week. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at the point where you have to wonder if there's really a path toward him reclaiming a more significant role again. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be happening. You know, some of that is health, but I mean, he's been practicing. I mean, he's not on the injury report at this point, and he's been. I mean, certainly when we talked to him coming into the season, he was very positive about where he stood with the knee and where he stood with his conditioning. So I think, look, he's a person that they value very highly in the culture of the organization. So they want to treat him well. But it seems like they've decided he's just isn't one of their top three tight ends. I mean, you know, I very few of us thought that Oliver was going to make the team, you know, even at the end of training camp. And he's playing a far more prominent role than Nick Boyle. So, I mean, I think that tells you all you need to know, really. And, you know, I mean, Ricard has sort of become their most important run blocker in the sense that Nick Boyle maybe used to be their most important run blocker. So, I mean, that's, you know, he's really an inline tight end in a lot of situations as well. So, I don't know what the path is for him. And, you know, he may be, I mean, I'm not going to retire the guy. I mean, he's a proud athlete, and you know, he has done really good things for this team, and you know, is a very respected player in the locker room. But I don't, you know, unless there's serious injuries in that group, it's hard to see how he gets on the field right now.
Yeah, it may be for contract purposes they really can't retire him because you know they accelerate bonus money if they do that, and they don't have any cap this year. So I'm not sure what options they really have with Nick Boyle, and that may be part of what's going on. But I also don't see the need to activate him if he's going to play seven special team snaps. So you the value that the Ravens would gain is they have a fourth tight end in case one gets hurt that they can then put on the field. But if they honestly want to exclude him from being on the field as much as they have in his two games back, I don't think they're gaining that much over, say, a sixth offensive lineman if they want to run a different type of three tight end scheme. for the difference between, you know, Boyle and whoever else it might be in there as the extra offensive lineman, maybe Cologne?
No, it's a good question. And I think it's something that a lot of us have wondered. I mean, I know it's something we've been talking about. So I don't know the answer, but I certainly share the thought.
Okay. All right. Well, outstanding. You know, we had 21 snaps out of actually Oliver's played 45 snaps the past 2 weeks, and really seems like the blocking tight end. I think I mentioned some stuff about 11 personnel, so we'll leave that. You know, one of the artifacts of going through a season like this, where you're using so many heavies and so few total wide receivers, is there's very little wide receiver opportunity on this team. Marquise Brown might have gotten out just in time in some ways, but you know, Bateman still gets a reasonable number of snaps. Robinson, until Bateman's injury, had gotten very few snaps. Prochet's barely gotten on the field for the same year. Same with Wallace. I mean, it's going to be more difficult to find, in my opinion, a free agent wide receiver that they like, that they want to bring in.
Yeah, I mean, the only guy who's obviously really taking a big step forward this year in terms of opportunity is Duvernay, in terms of how much he's on the field. Now, he's still not being targeted a tremendous amount. I mean, you know, you're probably talking what, 4 or 5 targets in his most prolific games of the season. He has done, obviously he's done a tremendous job capitalizing on his opportunities. I mean, I think he's been the most reliable receiver on the team and has made some big plays as well. But even though that's obviously a major success story for him individually, I think you're absolutely right. It's not like it's sending the signal to somebody from outside that, you know, wow, I'm going to come in and have 4 balls a game thrown my way. That's not what a top-notch free agent wide receiver is thinking. So no, I mean, that, if anything, I mean, we've heard that narrative for several years now, and I can't imagine it's going to go away. If anything, it's accelerated.
Yeah. And it, what it means, I think, is the Ravens are going to have to spend more draft capital at wide receiver, you know, get their guys that way instead of going. And honestly, given the quality of free agent receiver you typically get for the dollars involved, I think it's probably the right way to go structurally. You know, right now there's a big overpayment for veteran wide receivers that I think the Ravens have been very careful and effective at bucking that trend. And particularly with the upcoming Lamar contract, I think it makes all the sense in the world for them to continue to do so.
They have clearly decided we're not going to go shopping for edge rushers. We're not going to go shopping with wide receivers. They're not sensible buys, and they're just not going to do it. I mean, I agree. And, you know, obviously one thing that gets, or to me, that gets lost when people nationally talk about the Ravens offense and talk about the lack of wide receivers, is I do think that people do sort of discount the impact of Andrews. I mean, Andrews is not a typical tight end. He's making not in this last game, but most weeks is making a very outsized impact as a receiver. And though he's obviously not an outside number one wide receiver, you at least have to factor him in when you think about their pass catching talent, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Isaiah Likely, you know, potentially is that as well. So
could be. Yeah.
There's a lot. There's just fewer total targets in a Lamar led offense because Lamar is some of the pass targets by scramble. He's his own check down guy. So you don't have a butt. You lose some of those. In a way, Andrews is getting a lot of garbage targets in addition to his base targets. And I'm trying to construct a way to analyze this. But my theory is that there's decreasing marginal value to additional targets. The problem is trying to decide what targets are base targets and what targets are additional targets. But the notion would be that because Andrews is the go-get-the-football guy for Lamar, meaning when he's in trouble, he can't find anybody else, throw it to Andrews one-on-one, right. That's the automatic option. That's often going to be a contested target. It may be one that Andrews has to knock down the ball or catch, but he just has to do the best he can. And those are not going to be high percentage plays that he's going to get.
Well, and we saw, I think that instinct for Lamar led to the first interception. The one that was deflected. Now he was unlucky on the deflection in the sense that it went right up in the air and, you know, falls into a guy's arms. I mean, that's bad luck, but him sort of trying to quickly force the ball to Andrews and, you know, throwing low and directly into a defensive lineman was not bad luck. And
that's right.
You know, that sort of flows from what you're talking about.
Yeah. That absolutely was on Lamar. I agree. Let's talk about a couple of scheme things and we'll break this up and we'll come back for the second part, talk offensive line and whatnot. 8 of 14 set and chip blockers, 0.71 per play. That's a moderate number. It's a very high number for a game where the other team's rushing four every single play. So, you know, the fact that they need to chip whoever Fa'alelia is blocking on a substantial number of plays, and frankly, they need to do it for Moses as well, is something that is holding back the offense. A chipping eligible receiver can only run so many routes, not the standard ones. They don't have you don't get a route stem under those things. You can go flat. You can go, you know, some sort of short release route to be a check down guy. You can go out in and be a blocker for Lamar if he decides to scramble, but there just aren't that many things you can do with a check down guy.
Yeah. And that's obviously something where, you know, if we do get Stanley back soon, you know, does that number go way down? I mean, you would certainly hope so, right?
That's the big question. I want to save that for the beginning of the next segment. So let's do that.
Right.
They're very effective on draw plays in this game. I thought that was one of the really nice things is they allowed those edge rushers, particularly the ones who don't want to get any piece of Fa'alele, to basically run themselves out of the play to the outside and then get a draw play started that really created damage. I thought they're very effective doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we already talked about earlier. I mean, the big game by Hill on that last drive, which really put them in position to go for the touchdown. That was a draw.
All right. Tell you what, we'll take a short break here. We'll be back for the second part to talk about the offensive line, some individual performance. Childs, we appreciate you staying with us. Great, high quality content. Where can they find you on Twitter for starters?
Yeah. Just at Childs Walker. Very simple.
All right. Outstanding. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.